All right, welcome back, everyone. I'm Shannon Laird, and you're listening to BME Radio. Today's interview may be a little disjointed since I only found out I was doing it a few hours ago, so I apologize in advance for that. Anyway, here in the studio with us, we have Dr. Robert Stubbs, a Toronto-based plastic surgeon who's gained some notoriety by pushing the boundary of what his field allows. That said, I'd like to emphasize right off that he doesn't necessarily condone all of these sort of non-mainstream mods, and he certainly won't be the one to do your castration or subincision, so don't call him asking. That said, he will reverse your subincision for you, so if you are not happy with it, he's the one to call. Dr. Stubbs, thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I guess the first thing I'll ask you is, why won't you do a subincision?
Well, I guess it's part of my training in philosophy, plastic surgery, and cosmetic plastic surgery. I think the goal is to try and create a normal body form, or in fact a beautiful body form, and a subincision would be equivalent to what we would consider a congenital anomaly or hypospadias, and that type of problem is corrected, and so to create the problem would really go against the philosophy of most Western doctors.
Mm-hmm. But I think most people would agree with the sort of cliched statement that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. What right does a person have, in your opinion, to sort of choose where their body goes?
Well, and that's an excellent question, because, you know, society now says we're free, but then society also says collectively we have to look after the other person. And so, yes, you're free to smoke, but should you then be free to have health care that is paid for by the tax dollar of everyone else that doesn't smoke? So, yes, you perhaps should be free to modify your body, but that doesn't mean that you are going to get assistance from a medical practitioner. If there's a complication from a subincision, such as hemorrhage or infection, or some of the other extreme body modifications, that person will have to rely on the established health care in his particular country, and the health care community may not feel comfortable having to deal with this sort of problem if it becomes a regular occurrence. So I think it's buyer beware in terms of what you're going to do, both for established medical procedures, cosmetic surgery, or for some of the, we'll say, extreme body modification procedures that, mm-hmm. that people are requesting.
Mm-hmm. I think people who are regular BME readers sort of operate under the illusion that everyone who goes through the subincision is quite happy with it, but you recently reversed a fellow's subincision.
Not everyone is happy with their cosmetic surgery, so I'm sure there are going to be a whole group of people that either are initially unhappy with their body modification, or subsequently, as their lifestyle changes, may not be happy with it. So, yes, I did see a patient recently who had performed his own subincision, and his life circumstances changed where it was now a tremendous liability for him, and he was desperate to have it reversed, and the operation was successful.
Mm-hmm.
But it was only my training in urological plastic surgery and having dealt with babies with the same problem that I felt comfortable trying to help him. There wouldn't have necessarily been a lot of doctors who would have wanted to even accept him as a patient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was, can I ask, what was involved in actually putting them back together?
Let's just say doing something is a lot easier than restoring it or reconstructing it. And he did it himself, I think with ice, and in a couple of stages, but he didn't hemorrhage or have any major complications. He nicely splayed the glands of his penis. But to put that back together, there's now scar tissue there. And my concern at the time of surgery was, could I find suitable tissue to both line the urinary passage and to provide adequate external skin coverage? Because it's much like the nose. There has to be a good lining inside and a good coverage outside for it to be functional. And certainly with a male penis, the urine passage or the stream has to be unobstructed, or else it will splay, and the man would have to sit after that because he couldn't stand to urinate.
Mm-hmm.
But we were able to find enough tissue, and excise the scar tissue and reconstruct it in layers, and it held. I was concerned that perhaps he might develop what's called a fistula, where there'd be a communication somewhere along the reconstruction line.
And it wasn't just as simple as abrading the tissue and stitching it back together.
No, it's the much like a pierced ear. I see a lot of ladies who've pierced their ears and they have a child. The baby sees a bangle, grabs it, and in a sense pulls or makes a cleft of the ear lobule. And depending on the amount of scarring or infection or inflammation that occurred at the time, it's very difficult to try and create now a natural-looking ear lobule. And you actually have to cut away a lot of tissue and then reconstruct it in layers and keep your fingers crossed that it heals well, and it doesn't heal with a scar contracture where there might be an indentation or irregularity that would still be unsightly.
Mm-hmm. And a stretched ear could be repaired in an analogous way?
I guess repairing stretched tissue is one of the areas where plastic surgeons excel or have created a practice because, the fairer sex, ladies stretch. They undergo the big stretch. Men don't necessarily do that suddenly, and it's so in a very attractive 18-year-old woman who has a child and her breasts stretch, her belly stretches, and at age 20 she looks like, she says, her grandmother is very keen on having her original body form restored as closely as possible. So breast lifting and tightening, tummy tucks and tightening to restore, one's youth, or facelifts as one, gets older. All of this is stretched tissue. So an ear lobule that has been stretched, yes, there may be, more tissue there than you need, so you've got lots to deal with, but the circulation may have been compromised, and repairing something like that, which may seem simple at the time of the decision-making or the surgery itself, can sometimes turn around and not heal well, and then you're caught with something now that is quite severely deformed.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a short musical break. This is going to be some Ride. When we come back, I want to talk to Dr. Stubbs about when someone's found guilty?
Conviction?
The conviction of Dr. Brown when his patient whose leg he amputated died.
I can't see you.
All right, we're back with Dr. Stubbs. Dr. Stubbs, we were speaking over the break about Dr. Brown, and you were saying that he was probably operating outside of, even if he hadn't lost his license, he was operating outside the acceptable range of what a surgeon is allowed to do. How's that range defined?
Each country defines it very carefully because medicine, like religion, has to be well controlled. So there aren't false prophets or people without proper medical training posing as doctors and putting the public at risk. I know nothing about Dr. Brown or his case other than sort of what you've told me in the intermission. And certainly if what you told me was correct, that he amputated someone's leg while having his license suspended, that would be considered assault, and if the patient died, that would be manslaughter as far as the legal situation, I believe, that exists in Canada.
Now, if he had never been a doctor, would the charges be the same?
I would think so, because once someone dies, it would be equivalent, I guess, to you pushing someone off a bridge. If that person said, you know, please push me, I don't have the courage, and you did, that would be manslaughter. If someone said that, you know, they were depressed, would you please go and get them a pill or a gun, and you'd be an accomplice to it. So if a person dies as a result of hemorrhage from an amputation of an extremity, whether that person had requested it or not, I don't think the legal system really looks at that issue. It's who was responsible for this death.
Right. Now, you were saying you as a cosmetic surgeon, you have clear boundaries that you work inside, and even some of the more unusual procedures that you do are very clearly inside those boundaries.
Well, yes, the boundaries that I work within are changing. I mean, they're changing each year.
Well, and that's what interests me a great deal.
And some of the boundaries really are being, I guess, legislated by insurance companies, where they will say, we don't cover this anymore, and therefore a doctor says, well, I don't want to take the chance in doing a procedure where if something happened, I wouldn't have malpractice coverage.
So you'd be personally liable.
I'd be personally liable. And that's happening more and more in different countries, where they're looking at certain procedures, and cosmetic being one of the so-called high risks. Obstetrics is another high risk, where they're saying, well, fine, if you're going to do that, your annual premium will be like $100,000 a year rather than $4,000 a year. So that stops a lot of people, because there's no financial benefit anymore.
Or you'd have to charge an absolute fortune.
Exactly.
For procedures.
And then there's, you have no practice, because no one can afford to come. But certainly in Canada at the present time, and in our province of Ontario, the Ontario College of Physicians has pretty strict rules and regulations when it comes to certain traditional medical practice. But some of the things they don't have complete control over are some of the newer technologies that are evolving. They're just new technologies coming so rapidly that they cannot police that fast enough. And some of the new procedures, and some of the requests for the new procedures. So something like hymen reconstruction or labia minora reduction or penis lengthening. Some of the more senior members at the college who are physicians or lawyers have never even heard of these things or even thought people might want to have them done. And therefore, it's incumbent upon any doctor like myself to keep the college informed and say, listen, this is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it. Is it okay to do it? If not, I won't do it. But here's the reason I'm doing it. Do they want more information? So with penis lengthening, having been in practice for almost 20 years, I knew it was a hot potato in terms of our conservative society and my conservative medical establishment. And I, even before the college was aware of it, had asked an independent urologist and an independent plastic surgeon to oversee things. And the college was happy with that arrangement and was aware I was doing it, and they had full jurisdiction over coming into my facility at any time. Mm-hmm. Plus, my facility is accredited. So, I mean, in a sense, it's an established private hospital which meets all the highest sort of standards, and I was doing it with peer review. So anything new, most doctors will either do it within a hospital where there's peer review, or if it's a very private type procedure, such as what some of my patients request, it has to be done with a lot of openness so that you're not ostracized or charged.
Mm-hmm. Now, say there was a cosmetic surgeon that personally was all right with subincision. If he approached the college and said, I'd like to do this procedure, here's why the client wants it, here's why I believe it might be a benefit to him.
Well, the college, and I can't speak for them because one never knows. It's sort of like a child saying, you know, what will your parents do if you do this? Well, you know, you do it and see, but you never want to put them in that position. So I would think that if a good cosmetic plastic surgeon, or cosmetics are generic, so a cosmetic surgeon can be an otolaryngologist, a general surgeon, an ophthalmic surgeon, a dermatologist. So anyone can say they're a cosmetic surgeon, but let's say it's a plastic surgeon. If a plastic surgeon said, I'm getting a lot of requests for sub-incisions, there seems to be a demand. In fact, it's more than my rhinoplasties these days, and I'd like to accommodate this new group of patients that's coming in and do it properly, carefully, safely, you know, with good medical control in terms of sterility and everything else. I would think the college, and you could inquire from them yourself, would probably ask some representatives, senior representatives from both the urology division of one of the university hospitals, the plastic surgery division, what they thought of this. And my guess is that a professor of plastic surgery and a professor of urology would say no, and the college would then turn around and say, no, we don't think it's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Now,
To backtrack, you see, if a doctor 50 years ago had said, I want to do breast augmentation, the answer would have been no then, too.
What made it okay?
Well, because our attitudes have changed. Mm-hmm. And I was part of that changing attitude where one of the professors of surgery called me before him, and this was when I was a young resident, and he said, are you going to do cosmetic? And I said, cosmetic. I mean, I thought, like, cosmetics, you know, stuff women put on their face. I said, no, I'm a plastic surgeon, and my interest is hand surgery. And so he said, oh, well, I'm relieved because, you know, it would only be a second-rate doctor that did cosmetic, and you're thinking of coming back on staff at the university, and so it's important that we know where your interests lie. And I said, well, relax. You know, I'm going to be a hand reconstructive surgeon. But by the time I finished my training, another professor of hand surgery who I was training under said, you know, there's some of these hands that I fix, and they don't work so well afterwards, but because they look better, the patient's happy. So maybe there's something to this cosmetic stuff. But don't tell anyone I told you that. But I'll send you away for a year to the United States, and they're ahead of us in this cosmetic field, and see what you can learn when you're down there. So I was sort of in that transition phase where it was done but not done openly. And another one of the professors who worked at SickKids used to take his private patients to Central Hospital where he'd do the cosmetic, but then go back to SickKids where he was the reconstructive guru, and it was acceptable to be only a reconstructive surgeon. So I come from an era where you have to keep an open mind. I don't know if extreme body modification is going to be a trend that lasts for a long time. It may be transient. If it's going to be part of our Western culture and it's going to kill people, there may be a gradual shift to having doctors who are well-trained doing it properly. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I don't foresee that happening in the next year or two.
It's hard to say. Things sometimes change very quickly. I guess the other reason that sometimes doctors seem to start doing procedures, abortions probably being a good example, is that the feeling is that, well, it's better that a doctor does it. Even if I don't agree with it, it's better that a doctor does it than the person.
Well, exactly. You know. No doctor wants to work totally outside his own peer-reviewed system or society, because you get shot and no one respects you. Mm-hmm. And you know, who wants that if you train for 13 years to help people? I mean, you know, it's sort of the wrong thing. You may get a doctor who's psychotic that goes, you know, doing things, or someone who's, you know, a drug addict or a renegade that's, you know, you hear about. But the majority of doctors are reasonably sane people who've invested a lot of time, and will work for respect rather than actually money. Mm-hmm. So I'm just not too sure where the future is going at this point. But abortions, yes. I mean, women, young women were dying from septic shock from abortions. Now, the very wealthy pregnant young girls could go to the professor and have it done quietly and secretly. So in society, there's always, money has always moved things, you know, or made it easier for people that have that wealth. Mm-hmm. But the average citizen whose, you know, daughter got pregnant, she might die in the wrong hands. And so I guess everyone sat back and said, well, it's inevitable, human nature, young girls may get pregnant. And if they do get pregnant and it's not appropriate for them to be a mother for whatever reason, then perhaps it's better that it be done carefully. Now, I'm totally against abortion as being a form of birth control. So, in a sense, every doctor has their feeling. You know, if you work at St. Mike's Hospital, it's not fair to ask the doctors there to do abortions because, mm-hmm. you know, they are there because they have a certain religious conviction, mm-hmm. perhaps. But, you know, some women, rather than taking responsibility or purchasing appropriate contraceptives, see free abortion as a means of birth control, and I don't think that's appropriate.
Right. I don't want to move too far off subject, so I'll mention. I won't say his name, but one of the more well-known doctors that does elective castrations. He'd spent some time in prison for doing abortions in the past, and now is basically doing castrations for the same reasons he saw. He had a friend that was in the transsexual community, met some people who had done their own, and spent some time in a hospital, and he said, you know, this isn't right that these people, you know, they can't, not everyone can pass through those psychiatric doors and get approval for the procedure, you know, so they go ahead and do these procedures themselves, and he said, you know, this just isn't right, and now he's offering it without counseling, without
We learn from our mistakes, and we learn from things that work well. The most common cosmetic procedure in the world now is liposuction, and the reason liposuction came to be was because in Paris, in France, they legalized abortion. And therefore, the abortion clinics no longer had a business. And it's Western economics. You look for another business very quickly. And the doctor had been performing these outside hospital abortions. Now we're out of a job. But they remembered that the young ladies and prostitutes would often say, well, doctor, if you can suck out the baby, why not suck out the fat in my thigh? So the the abortionists turned into cosmetic surgeons, and they gradually got it right. And in fact, in the West, we couldn't believe that someone in Europe had got a new procedure ahead of us and figured something out. And therefore, a group of Ivy League professors from Harvard and wherever went over to study whether or not this actually worked. And by golly, it did work. And they came back and they put it to the scientific test properly here with endoscopic and everything. And yes, it did work, and it worked well. In fact, it worked so well, it became the latest thing, and it has helped a lot of people, because when I was in training, to get rid of a large fatty bulge on a pretty girl's thigh required a huge incision running almost from their knee to their hip, and you cut it out. Mm-hmm. Liposuction can be done with a 5-millimeter incision, and all I have to do is wear a girdle compression garment for 6 weeks, and lo and behold, when it comes off, it's like a butterfly coming out of a cocoon, a new body. But very few people, especially in established medical, hallowed halls, are prepared to admit that liposuction was invented by French abortionists.
Working on French prostitutes.
Exactly.
I love that story. That's excellent. Now, you had a few minutes ago, you'd mentioned hymen reconstruction and labial reduction. We're going to take another break, but when we come back, I want to ask you about those because there's sort of this bad word of female genital mutilation that surrounds them, and you know, and I'm sure you've had to deal with that a little.
Finally, they reached, according to certain maps, which were so unreadable as to be useless, the domain for which they had been searching. They had never known its name. All they found of human life on this coast was a wood house having the shabbiest possible condition. This oyster farm consisted of one salting house, the center of the shabbiness, three dead beds, deader fish smell, and the remnants of a burnt-down convent. As the pirates walked toward what they sought, now only by means of their dreams, one of the nuns, who was living in the hut, climbed up on top of a hill made out of her own excrement and began a speech in honor of this occasion. Dear sirs, rags stinking from dried sea spit were barely covering the bodies of her proposed listeners who almost never in their lives had listened to anyone. Dear sirs, our cunts are red. She wanted to speak more about cunts, but some pirate interrupted her, then another. Several started belching and grunting. Nevertheless, the pirates comprehended enough of her speech to perceive that they had arrived at the Temple of Eros, or of that dirt which is red. And this day was the birthday of the nun whose cunt was hungriest.
All right. Now, when most people think, when most people hear the word female circumcision, it conjures up horror stories of, procedures done with pieces of tin cans and
yeah. Well, circumcision in a sense is a misnomer. Well, it's a medical term. Most boys have heard the term circumcision. It means cut around. So we circumcise many parts of the anatomy when you do a breast reduction or breast reconstruction. There's a circumcision. You cut around the areola. So unfortunately, female circumcision, that term is being used really for the African ablation. In the West, there really wasn't anything quite equivalent to female circumcision. We had male circumcision, and certainly that's not a criminal offense. But when it comes to a female, the word circumcision, there's a law. You can go to jail for performing the African ablation, and that's in most Western countries now. I think they actually have legislation that makes it a criminal offense. So when women came to me initially to say that they were unhappy with their genitalia, that it was overgrown or underdeveloped or misplaced or too loose or too tight or whatever, and some of the procedures that I had to do required cutting around something, I got a little worried that I might be criminally charged, and or it might be misconstrued that I was doing an ablative procedure like what is done in Africa, where all of the external genitalia pretty well is removed, including the clitoris. So I sent a picture to our College of Physicians and Surgeons here with a healthcare worker, a lady who actually had assisted her family doctor. She worked in the office with all the female examinations. And so when the doctor was doing the pelvic exam, she was able to get a pretty close look at thousands of women's genitalia and perineum. And she knew that she herself was extremely large in terms of the labia minora. She didn't like it. It would sexual intercourse, it would catch with penetration. It didn't look nice in the shower if she was out publicly, and it would bother her when she was in sporting activity. So she wanted it reduced. Well, I had to cut around the clitoris in order to reduce the redundancy. And so that was a circumcision of the clitoris. And so the picture I sent to the College of Physicians and Surgeons was basically, here's what she has, here's what I want to do, here's the terminology, I don't want to be trapped in the semantics when I'm just trying to help this lady. And they said there's no problem at all. There is confusion in the lay population about the term circumcision. There is not the same confusion in the medical community as to what is being done. I go to great lengths to preserve the clitoris and sensitivity and actually try and make that whole area look nicer or more natural as opposed to what the person doesn't like.
And not just looks. I'm sure there's a functional enhancement as well.
You know,
or is that more psychological?
Well, there's this. What I started off very early in my career doing rhinoplasties, and sort of when someone's not happy with the looks of their nose, they also have a breathing problem because they feel it's easier for the doctor to accept the fact that he's going to make the nose look better and maybe make it breathe a bit better. So, in other words, it appeases the doctor and makes the patient feel like, you know, the doctor is being a good doctor and helping them with a functional problem. Just like a woman with large breasts may say she has back pain, yet she's 18 years old and she looks like, you know, she says a cow. She just really doesn't like the appearance because an 18-year-old could support a tremendous weight in their chest. And certainly in other cultures or tribes where they don't have brassieres, the young women don't sort of run around wanting breast reductions because of problems with weight. Mm-hmm. So what a patient says bothers them isn't necessarily the whole story. So yes, some ladies with large labia minora have dyspareunia or painful sex. Some have hygiene problems, they get rashes. Some have sporting activity problems where they get caught with bicycle riding and other activities or horseback riding. But when you get down to it, about 70% of their concern is cosmetic. They don't like something sticking out between their legs. In the anatomy books, it's called labia minora, little lips. They don't like their little lips bigger than their big lips.
I suppose. I think that, I guess what I was asking about is if the hood is quite large and the clitoris stays hidden away the whole time, now once you've exposed it, I'm assuming there's a functional difference afterwards.
I don't promise increased sexual gratification or more stimulation, or it's a sexual enhancement in the sense of a gain in that respect. What we're doing is we're trying to improve the anatomy. If they have better sex as a result of that, then I think that's great. And many of the patients are actually admitting this, which is not something that is my primary goal. Because I don't know, especially with men, is a uncircumcised man going to have better sex than a circumcised man?
I think each will tell you whatever they have is better.
Well, precisely. It's a subjective thing. I mean, you know, is your orgasm as good as my orgasm? Mm-hmm. Well, I've never had your orgasm, so I can't necessarily describe that. But I know that in adult males that I do circumcisions on, where they've had, 20 years of marriage as an uncircumcised male, and then we circumcise them, I said, well, tell me, you know, is it any better or worse? You know, is there a problem? And they say no. There's a trend perhaps today now to for better hygiene, and we are understanding with certain viral transmissions that a circumcised male may be a safer male. certainly to the female.
I think there's a lot of debate surrounding that, and
whether a circumcised female, and I'm talking about my circumcision, not the African type,
right?
If you're unhooding the clitoris or exposing it more, some of my patients have said that for the first time they've actually had a face-to-face heterosexual orgasm that they've never had before, simply because there is more contact and more stimulation. That they could do it manually, but that wasn't biblical, and that made them feel guilty. And some ladies who gained and lost weight would sometimes say, well, they would have to sort of hold their lower tummy in order to allow more contact, and that took away from the magic of the moment, and that distraction usually prolonged their stimulation period, and their partner had gone to sleep by then, so that was it.
Now, you'd also mentioned hymen reconstruction, which to me sounds a little funny. Why would someone do that?
Well, I guess in a Western society, it's, you know, how fast you can lose it. Certainly the football quarterback, you know, has a long waiting list of young high school girls that are waiting for his services. But in some cultures, it is a major cultural problem if the daughter of the family is not a virgin, because the family organizes the marriage. And certainly in Middle Eastern cultures, it can be such a disgrace that the oldest son or the father, it's his duty to kill the girl if they find out that she's not a virgin. Now, you know, how do they find out? Most men don't have a clue. And certainly most men, if it's an arranged marriage, may be as naive in bed as the virgin bride. And so in a sense, is this, you know, men against women? Is this a feminist issue? I don't think it is, because in a sense, it is the groom's mother whose responsibility is to check the virgin bride out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a woman's thing. But it's also a family thing. And the family thing is that it can be a terrible disgrace for the family. And it will immediately annul a marriage right on the spot.
So if a woman comes to you for this procedure, is it a secret that they're coming to you, or is there...
It's very secretive for them, because, you know, and just because a woman is not a virgin and she has a couple $1,000 and she, you know, wants it back, isn't the reason that I'm necessarily going to accept her as a patient. But a young girl who's studying at university away from home, and five men come through her dorm window and rape her, now is no longer eligible for marriage in her community.
But that's not your average client.
That's who I'm seeing.
Mm-hmm.
But this woman cannot tell the police, because in her country there's no protection of anonymity. Here, you're anonymous. You know, I was raped. There's teams. So a woman can be raped and no one can ever know about it. And in a sense, she is protected a lot more. But in another country, she has to endure the fact that she was raped. If she turns these guys in, she is now an outcast woman. She'll never marry.
Mm-hmm.
And so... In a sense, I feel somewhat sympathetic to that type of person. Or a woman who has been here studying at university. She has left the tradition of her family. But after she gets her degree, and she's had some pelvic exams by a family doctor who's ruptured her membrane, simply because at a certain age you have to have pap smears and annual assessments. And then she finds that her family's arranged a husband for her, and he's a very brilliant and wealthy person, and it's a family-arranged marriage, and now she's going, uh-oh, I got a problem. And her doctor, who is also maybe Middle Eastern, says, yeah, you do have a problem. You know, and he'll call and say, can you help this woman?
Mm-hmm. So you're, have you done any clients outside of that that culture?
I would say they've all been Eastern, Middle Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
There was one person that I wasn't sure if they were being entirely honest with me, and the more we chatted, I realized that this was an individual who was doing something for totally symbolic reasons, and in a sense, I sort of felt that this was a reasonable thing because I didn't feel that the man that she was going to meet, who was married and divorced and had two kids, she was married and divorced and had two kids, and they were going to meet, and the kids were going to be involved there, that this chap would think that she was somehow a virgin based on having had the children by immaculate conception, and I don't know what type of delivery. So when she told me that she and her boyfriend were escaping Russia, and he got caught and she got out, but she was saving herself, or they'd agreed that although it was very times of turmoil, and often people have sex during these periods, that they were not going to do that, and that they were saving this for when they both had their freedom, and then she got out, and he didn't. And then their lives settled down, and 20 years later, now that Russia was no longer restricting their borders, she was going back to meet him. And she wanted to take him something that he didn't have.
Symbolic rebirth,
so, almost. I thought that was a reasonable, because I didn't think I could be accused by anyone of doing something that was inappropriate.
Well, it's certainly told using some strange tools, but it's very much a valid love story, I think.
Yeah, it was a love story.
That's interesting too, because I wanted to speak to you about the different motivations that people have for plastic surgery, and sort of explore whether they're the same reasons that someone gets a tattoo. It sounds to me, now this is me as an outsider thinking this, and I'm sure people, have mistaken ideas about the body modification that BME is involved with. So I may be way off course here, but when people come to a cosmetic surgeon for a procedure, they do it because, they're unhappy with their body and they want to correct it. Whereas when someone goes, for piercings or tattoos, generally it's because they're pleased with their body and they want to enhance it even more. Am I?
There's similarities. There are a lot of similarities. And so, in a sense, the term body modification, yes, a cosmetic plastic surgeon is doing body modification. And the instruments are similar. We use tattooing. We'll tattoo a nipple on a breast reconstruction. We'll use scalpels and scissors and, all the instruments that are necessary, perhaps, in both fields. I have two classes of patients, I guess, coming. Those that have had it and want to get it back because they know they liked it before rather than now. And that can be anything from a woman who's aged and, she wants her tighter face back, or her breasts have drooped, or her tummy's lax. and then there's a group of people that have never had it. They've always had perhaps a nose that has been unsightly, and they would like a nicer nose. Or their ears have always been prominent, and they want them put back because people tend to look at their ears rather than listen to what they're saying. Or a woman who's really never had breasts and has never had that sort of feeling of femininity and the nice sort of warm approach that some men have when they want to sort of cuddle something that sort of looks nice that her girlfriends are getting and they've never had. They don't like being treated like one of the guys as much anymore. They like a little sort of pampering. So the motivation for cosmetic plastic surgery is, I find in my patients, not to be extreme. It's to look their best within an accepted range of, we'll say, normal. Mm-hmm. Body modification, I think from your perspective, is to make a statement outside normal, outside what culture and medicine and whatnot consider to be normal at that particular time, but not necessarily in the past and not necessarily in the present in other cultures. So, what is beauty and what is normal? That's a whole changing field. And so I have a comfort level as to what I don't mind doing. And so I have to listen to my patients to determine whether or not they're realistic and they fit within, my comfort level as far as what they understand.
Mm-hmm.
And the risks.
And Now, we've talked for a long time, so we're going to take a quick break here. But you have a screening process. You don't accept everyone that comes to you. And when we come back, I want to ask you, how do you determine that someone, you know, a procedure is right for a person?
Yeah.
All right. Now, a guy comes to you, wants a penis lengthening. How do you know that he's stable enough for that procedure? What sort of screening process is there?
There's no 100% sure way of screening out an unrealistic or a poor candidate. There's so much material that I have out there in the public domain to educate a patient and what to do and not to do and the things that may make them high risk, that a person that really wants that procedure may not be entirely truthful at the first assessment or examination, where I'm asking them critical questions that I need honest responses in order to determine their risk level.
What sort of questions would those be?
Any psychiatric history, any history of allergic reactions or past surgery, anything, any illnesses they may have, anything that I feel that may impact on the surgery itself, what medications they may be on, both prescribed and not prescribed medications. Drug reactions are probably the highest risk that can occur with most modern surgery, because what I give a patient, a drug cocktail that I know basically how it, the complications that may occur, the side effects, if a person has had cocaine the night before or is taking homeopathic medication or high-dose vitamins or steroids or supplements of some sort, all of these can create a lethal or a really detrimental cocktail.
I'll mention the interesting one. I think we talked about this last time, is garlic.
Garlic. I had a patient that was taking high dose garlic, and I knew that because I could tell he smelled the. He took garlic pills, which didn't smell, but he also liked to supplement it with the stuff that does smell, and he bled after his surgery, and he was a good patient. So, in a sense, I didn't think he'd done anything after the surgery that had promoted the bleeding, and his procedure went very smoothly. But he ended up with a hematoma that was totally unexpected. So. I started doing medical detective work, and the first thing I said was, you know, are you taking any drugs or anything that you think might have caused a bleeding problem? He said, I don't take anything except garlic. And so I looked up garlic in the medical literature, and sure enough, there's a component of garlic which thins the blood. And I think there's a component of garlic also that helps protect you against virus infections. So garlic, in a sense, I guess, has been used throughout the ages in food and has some medicinal benefit. And certainly as a blood thinner, it probably protects you against strokes and heart attack. But you don't want to be on it if you're going to have elective surgery. And that we knew that with aspirin, but we didn't know at the time I was training. I did ear, nose, and throat training, and part of that was tonsils. You do a list of 10 tonsillectomies a day. They were, you know, very quick procedures. And 1 in 100 patients would have a severe bleed, and a portion of those would die. And this was, we didn't really understand why until we figured it out, that kids were being given aspirin. Parents give them, they had a sore throat. You've got tonsils, tonsillectomy, they were giving them aspirin. Aspirin was thinning the blood, stayed in the body for 2 weeks. They had a tonsillectomy within that period of time. They're at high risk of hemorrhaging to death.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it stayed in that long. I guess when guys come in for a penis lengthening, do a lot of guys have sort of unrealistic notions as to what can be done?
I had a chap who had a 12-inch penis, and he wanted another 2 inches because he heard that was sort of the maximum that we could sort of lengthen the organ. And I was astounded. I mean, I said, this is the biggest penis I've ever seen, let alone, you know, this week. Why do you want to have this done? And he said, well, he was the man. He never worked a day in his life. Women paid for everything, and he would sort of be invited over for a week or two, and he probably fathered most of the children in his community. And I won't mention which one it is in Toronto in case they take offense to it. But he was worried that number two and number three contenders, who were 10 and 11 inches, I believe, might have the surgery and then take over his top spot. And so I quickly explained to him that there were certain risks with the procedure, and all my patients have to read the risk sheet before I'll see them. And I said, well, you know, did you not look at these risks? Because the first one mentions death. And his English wasn't terribly good. He was not, Canadian born in a sense, having sort of grown up here and learning the language well. And so I said, well, here are all these risks, including impotence and, deformity, and you might not get any gain at all. And he said, well, maybe I'll think about it, because if the other guys come and they have this problem, then I'll have no competition. And he didn't have surgery, which is great. But
and as I understand it, if it's sort of a percentage increase, so he could have walked away with a 15-inch.
Well, you see, I guess the misquote I had when I got back was when I was in China, I saw a 4-inch penis being lengthened to 6 inches.
Right.
And simple mathematics says that's a 50% gain.
Right.
Okay. So somehow the media took up this word 50%. And therefore, guys with, 8-inch penises were coming in that wanted to sort of go past the 12-inch mark.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, you just don't have that much buried inside that I can safely release in order to give you a 4-inch increase. It's about a 2-inch increase, which is max, or 6 centimeters. And so for a man who's 4 inches, that's a big improvement. For a man who's 8 inches, that's not as significant a change.
Well, although 10 inches is still quite massive.
I've learned for men, there seems to be no limit. The bigger, the better. There isn't a cutoff. For breasts, women have this full B cup is sort of the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
For guys, I'm afraid there is no, 5 inches is fine. Guy who's 5 wants to be 6. 6 wants to be 8. And 8 wants to be, bigger if
sure.
you can.
You've seen my truck. I think it moves into everything that most guys do. There don't seem to be limits. This is probably a little bit outside of your...
You asked me how I select the patients. Well,
yeah.
We've done almost 500 pure lengthenings,
mm-hmm.
okay? Maybe 1,000 genital enhancement procedures for men, which includes the full range of things from thickening to circumcisions and reversals and all that sort of stuff. But the lengthening is the most popular. We've done about 500. But in the 7 years that I've done it, I must have seen 5,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
So... they all ask about lengthening, whether they have one, thing or another. That seems to be what they're all interested in knowing a bit more about. But once they read the risk sheet, the majority of the not so seriously interested decide, they'll live with what they got.
Do you publish, I don't know if these numbers are published. Now, you said you've done 500. How many of those have walked away with problems?
I published a paper in the Canadian Journal of Plastic Surgery, which is on the internet. It was on the internet in its entirety. It was stolen by a couple of people and whited out, and search engines were, thinking that people were, doctors included, were going to my article, and then they got rerouted with a click here to some ear, nose, and throat doctor's website in the States who wanted to be a fellow plastic surgeon. So the article that I wrote on the first 300 was basically the cookbook of how to do it with all the risks included. It was a peer-reviewed article in the Canadian Journal of Plastic Surgery. I'm told by the publisher that it is the most popular paper they've ever put on the internet. It has the most number of hits per day, and which may be the most read article of any medical journal in the world, because the world has access to it through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But the risks are everything from severe infection to very mild sort of jock itch problems that guys were getting in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
No one died. No one lost feeling. No one had impotence from the operation itself, but we had one older gentleman who got, I would say, probably full-blown impotence from the injection that we use at the beginning of surgery, which creates an artificial erection. We didn't know how long this was really going to last, and we sort of looked at the, and this was right at the beginning, we looked at the pharmaceutical literature and thought it would wear off. It didn't wear off. He didn't tell us. He didn't speak English well. And so it was a communication problem and the learning curve at the beginning. Now we still use that medication, but no one leaves the facility with an erection anymore,
mm-hmm.
simply because we don't know if it's not going to go down.
Mm-hmm. What percentage have experienced actual loss of length? Or is that largely aftercare?
That's aftercare. the operation as it stands now is not to get the maximum length of the time of surgery. It's to get the most release, to fill the space that you create or the release of the ligament with tissue that is now stretchable, and that is skin and muscle.
Mm-hmm.
If you apply traction to a penis that's intact, in other words, its ligament is intact, you'll stretch the corpora, the internal part of the penis, just as you'll stretch skin. And then you'll get a dysfunctional penis. You won't get erections. So there, and this we know because there are religious priests in northern India, the Sadhus, where they earn money for their religious group by showing female Western tourists their 2-foot penises, because they hang 20-pound bricks on them when tourists aren't around. And then they have these super long, stretched, thin rubber band penises that they wrap up, put in a basket between their legs, and then when the right tourist pays the right amount, out it comes. But they're celibate, so they don't care if they don't have erections. I haven't had a single man that's approached me for a bigger penis that was prepared to sacrifice erections for a longer penis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're running short on time, so we're going to take a short break. I'll mention who I was just about to say. There's a guy called Master E that sells vacuum pumping equipment. Now, he's been vacuum pumping heavily, I think, now for 25 years. His penis, a penis at this point, measures in circumference is 15 inches, bigger than my neck, and it's still functional apparently. Anyway, like I said, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll finish up with Dr. Stubbs when we're back. Okay, we're back with Dr. Stubbs. Now, at least in Canada, and you can do it in the States too. It's just a little bit more difficult. Someone that wants to have a someone outside of the medical field do procedures on them, they can fairly easily obtain all the supplies, including anesthetics. As a medical professional, what sort of risks would you warn people that they're putting themselves at? And I realize, you know, you can only say so much for obvious liability reasons, but.
There are risks that we all know because, the media pick up on these stories. Carla Homolka, one of our notorious serial killers, killed her sister with an overdose of anesthetic. In the States, there was a plastic surgeon who went on holiday, and one of his OR nurses, who'd seen him do liposuction, thought it was an easy operation, and had one of her friends, her neighbors, in, and said, "Oh, I'll do liposuction on you because it's simple. I've watched the doctor do hundreds of cases," and she killed her neighbor. Had a surgical mishap, and she was charged with manslaughter. Through veterinary supplies or through connections one might have within the medical field.
When Canada's over the counter.
Hospitals, just you go to some of their garbages, what gets thrown out. You could put a small hospital together.
In Canada, over the counter, everything, general anesthesia supplies, everything.
Well, certainly, you know, it's hard to restrict things because if someone is, say, a diabetic or they have a medical condition.
Or wants to put together a solid first aid kit or whatever.
Precisely. So many of these things which are out there for, we'll say, emergency or medical necessity, can be used for other means. And therefore, it's because a person has all of this equipment, does that now immediately turn them into a qualified surgeon? I'm still humbled, and I still continue learning. It's called CME, continuing medical education. So in a sense, I don't think, unless an individual's had a proper medical training and background, should they be taking the risk of performing anything on any other human.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of brings me to what will be, I think, my final question, which is, say someone wants one of these extreme body modification procedures that really isn't accepted by doctors. They have been through counseling, and they can't get rid of this urge. They really are quite certain this is what they want, and they've reached the point where either they have to have someone else do it to them or they'll do it to themselves. What should someone do at that point?
I guess that's like, you know, what's happening with gender dysphoria. In Toronto, we had this whole system with the Clark Institute and University of Toronto Hospitals where we could gradually transform a man into a woman with all the safety nets, with all the counseling, all the guidance, over the two-year period. If someone now wants to undergo this transformation, they just can't get it in Toronto because no doctor is going to work in isolation because he knows there's going to be a problem. You need the whole team. An individual who, say, wants a finger amputated because this is something that they've always wanted and it's always nagging, urging, and nagging their mind, I'm sure they can go out of the country to do this because there are doctors in other countries that are not as well controlled as certainly in Canada and United States, and there are many people that will do anything for money. What concerns me is the quality of care they will get, and if there is a complication such as infection or something else, or if there's a poor quality control in terms of the sterility of the equipment, they may get more than just a missing digit. They may die or have an infection.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks a lot for talking to us today, Dr. Stubbs. If people want to get in touch with you, they can do it via your webpage at...
The website, I think, would give a lot of information because it has the risks that, as a surgeon, I tell patients.
I'll obviously link that from the interview page, but if they've sort of strolled over somewhere else by then, it's psurge.com. And again, I'll say, don't even bother emailing you if you want a castration or a subincision. That's not what you do. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
You're most welcome. Dr. Rock, hold me out for I need to shout. Dr. Rock, look again.
die.